This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Marvin Campos is a life coach, but not the kind you would expect when you hear that title. Here in Chattanooga, he works for an outreach program called Building Stable Lives, sponsored by the Partnership for Families, Children, and Adults. The program, funded by the United Way, connects families in need with the social services they require. Marvin, who is bilingual, serves families in Eastlake, primarily immigrants from Guatemala. He stopped by Scenic Roots. Marvin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you become a life coach?
Oh my gosh. I have no idea. Let's see. I got my master's in social work after I realized I had to get a master's after getting my undergrad in psychology. So I was working at Clinica Medicos, which is on Holtzclaw, really great. I just spoke Spanish. They were offering jobs if you were bilingual. And I'm like, I have no medical background. They're like, that's fine. You speak Spanish. We'll teach you. You don't need much. I was doing my master's in social work, kind of looking at jobs here and there. I picked up a government job, but you needed some experience there. And that wasn't working out. And I did my internship with the partnership on 8th Street. And that's where the domestic violence shelter is. They have a great program there. My supervisor, not then, but now, she was like, hey, I have this position for you. It's a life coach. You get to work with the Hispanic community. We'll give you some free range on that. Come by. And I'm like, a life coach is like the ones on LinkedIn that do Skype interviews. She's like, no, we just call you that, but it's a lot. So that's how I became a life coach. So when you Google life coach, I'm not what you Google.
Well, tell us more about what you do at Building Stable Lives.
So the program is a little bit like case management in a sense. But with life coaching, the model is building or creating stability within families. The program is 18 and older, so adults mostly. So what we do is go into low-income neighborhoods. So I'm in Eastlake. We have someone in Alton Park. We have someone up in Family Justice Center. We have people in East Chattanooga. There's like five of us, so we're all over, and we're usually try to be out of community centers. My supervisor is out of the Bethlehem Center. And basically, we are in there to try to create more stability for maybe that community center as well as the neighborhood. So being in the Salvation Army, you know, they have social services there and they have after school care programs. But me being there, you know, kind of added another level of case management. Again, I want to use that word. So if you come in, you know, you might want to move out of your neighborhood, move out of a school, get better job. Some people might have come out of certain situations and they're having a hard time getting in the door for jobs or in the house or have just moved to Chattanooga. So a lot of times we're like a reference point. We kind of connect them to that. But at the same time, we're kind of like cheerleaders. We're also that maybe mentorship that they might not have.
A bridge.
Yeah. Someone to keep them accountable if that's what they want. And I tell my clients all the time, I'm like, it's what you want to be in this program. You know, I'm not your parent, you know, if they're younger. I'm not a teacher. I'm not your boss. I'm here to help you. I'm here to elevate you. So you don't have to come in here like, oh, I have to come in here and talk to my life coach. We try to build a little bit of a friendship so they're comfortable and see that we're trying to help them win. And we're there to celebrate those wins with them.
What are some of the problems that you see with people coming to you, some of the challenges they face?
A lot of them are in, like I said, low-income neighborhoods. So there's not a lot of connection there, not a lot of resources. So a lot of times people might not have transportation, but they need jobs. So a lot of times people want to maybe get a job in their neighborhood. And that's kind of hard to do. So a lot of times as a life coach, we kind of present questions to them to kind of like make them see outside of the box they might be in, you know, present new ideas. So example, we have like bus cards that we help them out with if they're in part of the program. So we're like, here's a good job you can get, but it's outside your neighborhood. How do we work to encourage you to work outside your neighborhood? And sometimes people have never left their neighborhood. So it's refreshing for them like, oh, you know, like I can work outside of here. I can work this out, you know, and we tackle everything, you know, like, oh, but I have kids. How is that going to work? You know, so we try to connect them to programs. For example, I had this lady who worked throughout the whole summer and she didn't realize, she did, but she didn't really think about it ahead of time until it was too late that like, oh, my kids are going to be home all alone the whole summer while I work. We, you know, we quickly worked out a way to get their kids into summer camp and for that summer camp to pick up the kids, you know, but a lot of times as life coaches, we try to present these things before they happen. You know, a lot of people are trying to get their bill paid today and they're not thinking about the bill that's going to come tomorrow or the next week. So as a life coach, we, you know, we try to let them see a bigger picture outside from week to week, which is hard because I graduated 2 years ago and sometimes I live paycheck to paycheck. I'm not thinking about what's going to happen if I'm in the hospital for some reason, you know, that's going to wipe me out. So a lot of times that's what the biggest problem for them is, maybe thinking a week ahead, a month ahead.
Tell me more about the population that you're helping in Eastlake.
So the reason why they put me in Eastlake is because I'm bilingual, and that's where a lot of the Hispanic population is at. So my supervisor kind of gave me a free range to figure out what the need is and try to fulfill that need. So I kind of do a little bit of life coaching with them, but at the same time, it's community outreach or community members. They're not necessarily in the program, but at this point, it's more emergency management with them. The life coaching program, you know, we kind of are moving away from, like, if someone's homeless, try to get them into a house, try to get them to a job. We try to get outside of that where maybe they're already in the house, but how do we keep that? But with the Hispanic community, I've run into the biggest problem they have is a lot of them are immigrants. A lot of them don't speak English, don't know they have resources. So the population I work with a lot of times is trying to build that trust with them and just let them know they have resources, let them know that I'm there to even just interpret a document or show them where a hospital is or a school or anything.
How long have you been in Chattanooga?
I was looking at a Facebook thing. I think it's 6 years now. You know, Facebook reminds you what you were doing 6 years ago, a day ago, whatever. But I think I've been here 6 years, but I was in school here, and I'm from Minnesota, so we go back home for the summer or whatnot. But stable, I'd say, I think 4 or 5 years.
And you've lived in more than one state in the Midwest.
Yeah. It took me a while to realize that not everyone moves around a lot. Yeah, born in Los Angeles. My parents met there when they immigrated to the United States. My dad came here when he was 16, running away from the war in El Salvador. My mom did the more common thing at the time where she flew here. She thought she was going to help her family babysit some of her nieces and nephews and just stayed. She fell in love with my dad. They met.
And she came from where?
Mexico. Yeah. So they met. I was born there. Really dangerous area. We lived in East LA, Boyle Heights. My parents were like, this is not safe. Somehow ended up in Kansas. Just moving around for jobs, and my dad got a more stable job in, let's say, Wichita, Kansas, then Kansas City, Missouri, where my brother was born, and then we stayed in Omaha, Nebraska for 8 years. He had a good stable job there. My mom was able to get into the school system, and that's when they started working on, like, their green cards and whatnot, but we lived in immigrant communities my whole life until we moved to Minnesota, and I realized, like, oh, I guess I never realized that that was a community until I was in Minnesota, and then I came down to Chattanooga and wasn't with my parents and had my own neighborhoods. I'm like, oh, wow, I was raised in an immigrant community. So I feel like that really has helped me get in touch with the communities I work with a lot. I can relate to them. I know where they can find help. A lot of times it's at, like, grocery stores or carnicerias, the meat shops and stuff. So a lot of times I try to go there and just get to know the owners and just let them know, like, hey, there's someone out here for them, you know. But at the same time, it's sketchy, you know, as growing up in immigrant family and parents, you know, we always try to stay under the radar. You know, you never look for help because you're in a country where you're illegal and you're just trying to make it, try to provide for your family. So it's been hard too, you know, as someone who's Hispanic, speaks Spanish, knows the culture, a lot of times I still don't understand, like, why is this person trying to give me free help? It takes time. I'm not trying to rush it, but at the same time, you know, sometimes it helps when I get connected through a clinic. You know, I still work with Clinica Medico, so Dr. Arnold will call me sometimes and be like, hey, we have this person that doesn't have anyone, just arrived to the United States. Or I work a lot with Clifton Hills, and they're like, we have this mom, 4 kids, husband was deported, she's never worked, she just gave birth to a 4th child or something, can you help her? And that's the part where it's like, they have no one else. The very least I can do is be someone that can interpret for them or explain to them that they can apply for food stamps or get transportation. And I think that's been my most beneficial and, I don't know, kind of keeps me going. Because a lot of times you can get kind of down on yourself, you know, like, oh man, like, I wish I could do more. But at the same time, you know, just the fact that you speak this language that they do is a big help. Kind of gives them that motivation and another hand up, if you will, to help them make their life a little easier, just a little bit.
How does living and working in this area compare to the other places where you have lived and worked before now?
That's a good question. I've realized that Chattanooga, the people that I've worked with, born and raised in Chattanooga, like to tell me that Chattanooga is not what it was 20 years ago or 10 years ago. I moved in at the perfect time, I feel like, as a young millennial who enjoys entertainment and food and stuff, because it's been great. You know, we have so many cool things, and it's still small enough that you don't feel overwhelmed, and it still feels unique. So for that part, that was great. But working with a community, there's not enough resources for the Hispanic community. Growing up in Minneapolis, huge city, there's resources left and right. Even in Omaha, there was resources there. But in Chattanooga, the resources we have aren't growing fast enough with the population. And I feel like that's normal with any smaller city that just got bombarded with a fresh group of different people or immigrants or whatnot. So that's the biggest difference and probably the biggest obstacle. It's been like finding those resources. And nonprofits are doing a really good job of trying to meet that. But a lot of times I get like, hey, you know, we have this service for the Hispanic community. Here's a flyer in Spanish. That's awesome. Like, when they call, is there someone that speaks Spanish there? Like, oh, no. Okay, so how would they be able to get help? We haven't thought that far. Can you help? You know, and I don't mind helping, but as you know, my workload gets more busy and my supervisor reminds me to stay in my lane, you know. I just wish we had more Spanish-speaking professionals or resources for the community. So that's been the biggest difference in Chattanooga.
Where would you like to see things 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
So what I try to do when I work with anyone or try to reach out to anyone, it's like if someone comes here for the first time to the United States, regardless of where they're coming from, you kind of want to have somewhere where they can go to and kind of like, welcome to Chattanooga, welcome to the United States. Here are resources. Here are your general rights you have in this country. Here are locations that can help you with what you need to establish yourself. Because a lot of times with the Hispanic community we get, they come here and they have family or something. But a lot of times I find people who have no one. Just came here with a backpack, might not have a mattress, might not have a blanket, doesn't know where a clinic is. That's why Clinica Medicos opened up, was because a lot of people were going into the hospital when they had a cold. They didn't know that there was a clinic. So for me in 5 years, I'd love to have like a resource hub or a section of maybe even the partnership dedicated to Spanish-speaking services to just kind of people can go there as a resource guide, regardless of what it is.
And where can people go online for more information?
Partnershipfca.com. They tell you all the resources they have. You know, they have deaf services, they have elder services, they have the domestic violence shelter. They're a huge nonprofit. They do great work in everything they do. And hopefully Building Stable Lives, you know, has a lasting impact like the other services they offer.
All right. Marvin, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Make way for native plants this weekend on this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. On Saturday, the Plant Natives 2020 Symposium and Native Plant Marketplace and Expo comes to the University Center from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Christina Schenefeld is with the Tennessee Valley Chapter of Wild Ones, which is presenting the event. Christina, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Tell us more about the Tennessee Valley Chapter of Wild Ones.
We're a nonprofit. We're part of a national organization called Wild Ones Natural Landscaping. It was started by Lori Otto in the Wisconsin area, and it has traveled. We have created chapters all across the country. Tennessee Valley, I believe, is still currently the largest chapter in the country. We have also helped start two chapters in Tennessee, the Smoky Mountains chapter and Middle Tennessee chapter, and have still remained the largest chapter in the country, which is really cool. We are dedicated to the idea of healing the earth one yard at a time. That's kind of our motto. Many of us are homeowners who have looked at the insect collapse and all of these other things and said, okay, what's going wrong? How can we fix that? And then finding people who are of like mind, people who also promote the same things. Without native plants, we don't have many of our native insects. Without those insects, the birds don't have food, and on, that kind of spirals all the way up to us. So with over 40 million acres of lawn across the country, part of our mission is to say we can help. We can't put back exactly the right biodiversity or exactly the right ecosystem necessarily by ourselves. Not without lots and lots of study. But what we can do is bring the plants that we know are host plants for insects and butterflies and, of course, caterpillars before the butterflies and all that stuff. We can bring those back into our home landscapes and help offset some of that fragmentation that conservationists are so concerned about. Fragmentation is where we develop and disturb natural areas, and we have large swaths where there's no room for forage for insects and birds and other wildlife. So that fragmentation of habitat is where we're getting most of the die-off, where we're getting most of our problems. And so that's kind of a way that we can put that back into place.
And you're bringing your mission to this campus.
Yes. Yes. Each year we love the UTC campus. We use the University Center and the auditorium. The Tennessee Room is fantastic. They let us bring in plants. And so we bring in speakers each year. This year we have three. And one will do two talks, and then each one will do one after that. And then at the same time, while we're doing the symposium portion for the education part, we'll also be running the Marketplace and Expo on Saturday, and it will be 8:30 to 4:30. We'll have six native plant vendors, so you can buy plants, you can buy artwork, you can buy pottery, you can look at the different conservation groups that are around town. We have a lot of those people who will be there in the expo, and they'll have their literature and be able to talk to people about what they're doing in addition. So it's a great event. We usually are packed out, so each year. We maxed the auditorium last year, so it was really cool.
Let's talk about the speakers one by one.
Dr. Benjamin Vogt is our keynote speaker. He's the author of A New Garden Ethic. He lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. He owns a landscape company who specializes in installing these native landscapes and ecosystems. And he will be doing two talks. The first one will be about his book and the reason for his book and his kind of purpose for being. And then his second talk will be about busting those native garden myths where people say, oh, yeah, native plants aren't pretty, or if you just let your grass grow, that's the same thing. And it's not the same thing as a native landscape. So he'll be talking about some of those things. Our second speaker is Philip Juris. He's from Athens, Georgia. He's an artist. And so it's a very different speaker for us this year. His interest is in not just native landscapes, but he paints those landscapes. One of his most interesting topics is Bertram's Trail, which was kind of a description of what the South looked like before we changed it. And he has a series of paintings that follow along throughout the southern area. He'll be talking about picturing what nature's design looks like as we landscape in the South. And then our last speaker is Dr. Bodhi Panisi. She's from the University of Georgia, and she'll be talking about how to create healthy, biodiverse communities with native plants, with pollinators and other beneficial insects in mind.
What else does the Tennessee Valley Chapter of Wild Ones have going on the rest of the year?
We are a membership-based organization, so we love to have members join us, and we do member-only events. A lot of times we do hikes. We do what we call a landscape in progress, or LIP for short, and that's where you get to visit someone who's been working on their landscape, and it could be earliest stages to a mature native landscape that has been just really productive and happy. So we do a lot of members-only events, but we also, our main goal is to educate and to help other people learn how to do native plant gardening and what kind of conditions and how native plants work, why they're important. So we hold 8 or 9 monthly public meetings, usually the second Monday of the month at Green Spaces at 6 o'clock. Those public meetings are different each month. You can find a list of those on our website. We also, this year, have started the Basic Gardening Roundtable. So it will be groups of people. You can ask questions. It'll be some education, some interaction, and we'll have 3 of those this year. We pretty much stay busy all year long. This year, we also have a native plant garden tour in the fall. That will be in September, and we will be bringing in Nancy Lawson, who wrote The Humane Gardener, as our speaker the night before that event. That's September 12th, 11th and 12th.
And where can people go online for information about the event here at UTC and everything else that you do?
You can find all of our information at tnvalleywildones.org.
All right, Christina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. A Hidden Gem by Agatha Christie will shine at Chattanooga Theater Center. The Hollow, a lesser-known thriller by the Queen of Mystery, opens Friday and runs through Sunday, March 29th. Director Bob Willey and cast member Johanna Fredrickson drop by Scenic Roots. Bob, Johanna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell me about The Hollow.
The Hollow, it's one of Christie's lesser-known works. But to me, it is the most incredibly written of her works. She was extremely proud of it. It was the second play that she ever produced, and it took her 3 years to get it on stage because of various problems. They wanted her to insert a character, the Perrault character, which she did not want. She was sick of Perrault at the time, and so she refused to have Perrault in the show. So it took a while, but The Hollow is interesting to me. It's a murder mystery, obviously, as all of her shows are. But The Hollow has such a heart to it. And it's called The Hollow, and to me it's a perfect title because every one of the characters have a hollowness in their heart that they're trying to fill in one way or another. The character development is absolutely incredible. It is so well written. You know, it's a long play, and when I first got the play, I went, how is an audience going to sit through a play that the book was, I believe, written in 48, and then it produced the play in 52. Audiences aren't used to long plays anymore.
How long are we talking?
With intermissions, it's still under 3 hours, including the intermissions. But audiences today aren't really used to that.
And well, no, it's short attention span theater.
Yeah, and so I would like the audience to just step back in time for a while when this was your entertainment for the month. Every line is so packed with meaning that still reaches you today. What I also find interesting is when she wrote this, the British Empire was collapsing. Everything was changing. And there was a lot of fear. What is going to happen? The empire is going, you know.
This was the aftermath of World War II.
Yes.
This was as the colonies were becoming part of the Commonwealth and no longer colonies.
Right. And so there's a huge fear from the butler to the heads of the household. What is going on? And what is going to happen to us? And I think that relates to where we are today on many levels, that everyone has a fear from coronavirus, to what is going to happen with the government and political race right now. And everyone is glued. And it was the same fear, dread, and wondering what is going to happen to us. So it's not just a murder mystery. It's about people and their relationships.
And one of the people, Johanna, is played by you.
Yes. And such a fun play. I've sat through all the rehearsals. You know, obviously I'm an actor and I'm acting in them, but just sitting back and watching my fellow actors, there's something in every character that a person can relate to. It's such a fun show. I think, I don't know, I've enjoyed watching it over and over again. So I think there's something for everyone, even just to sit back and analyze the characters and think about who reminds you of who, because each person is very developed.
Tell me more about your character.
My character, I think she's the firecracker. She kind of comes in and she's very selfish. She has one goal in mind, and that's to get back her love, the love of her life. How much can I say?
Yeah, you're fine.
who's currently married. So she's definitely a character.
Yeah, she's a pretty renowned actor who has come back to London with her main interest being finding this love for her life from 10 years ago to, again, help fill the hole in her heart. She's a powerful character.
How do you dive into a character like that?
Oh, just keep digging. I like to pull up a lot of past pain and suffering and bring that to the forefront because everything relates to everything. You know, if you've ever experienced loss in your life, then I just pull that up and refer in it, because I don't have a 10-year lost love that I'm searching for, really. But I do. I have things that I miss and that I've lost, so I just pull from that, which then makes acting very therapeutic to bring that kind of suffering back up to the forefront and really let it go. One thing I really love about acting is that it's a process of re-experiencing things you've had happen in your life and turning it into a positive light.
And sharing that.
And sharing it, yeah. So hopefully the goal would be that the audience, when they experience it, can maybe let go of some of their loss and pain. Or to, I don't know, they can hate me if they want to. Maybe I remind them of someone that they don't prefer to have in their life. And that's good, too, because you can get some of the angst out.
And what's it like to put on a play such as this for a community such as Chattanooga?
Oh, it's such a dream. And that's the other thing. I feel like everyone in Chattanooga can relate to this play because it's small. Everyone's away for a weekend in a cabin. So cabin fever lurks around the corner and everyone's very close and it's family orientated.
For Chattanooga, I think they're going to be expecting the standard Christie. This is a very funny play. There's
when we say funny, we mean dark comedy?
No. Well, not really dark comedy. There's some of it. But the character Lady Angutel, who is the matriarch of the family, is extremely absent-minded, and some of it's an act, and some of it isn't. And she is absolutely hysterical. And I sit there after all this time, and I'm still laughing. And I know every line in the play, but she just breaks me up. And she's doing such a great job at it that I'm just thrilled to have such a remarkable cast.
It sounds like if you had the chance to see Knives Out in the movie theater, you might really like this.
Yes.
It's not the same story, obviously, but...
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
You've mentioned that this touches on themes that echo here now. It touches on things that are timeless. What process did you have to go through to just make things accessible? Or do you feel the work just kind of laid that out for you?
For me, as the director, I went into this going, okay, here we go. It's an Agatha Christie. For a director, it was not my genre. I've done mystery. I'm more of a Tennessee Williams person or an Arthur Miller person. Really, works that bite at your soul. And new works. I love doing new works. But this Christie came up, and I read it, and I went, okay, I think I can do something with it. And I just started finding things in it that related. And every day, I find more things. And as a director, I take a lot from my actors. And actors teach me as much as I'm teaching them. So it's a continual search to find the meaning and bring Christie to life. And so much of Christie's life is in here. In the First World War, she worked at a pharmacy for the military. And it was there that she became enamored with poisons, working at that pharmacy. She also underwent a very terrible relationship with her husband, who was a World War I pilot, who later had an affair, left her. She disappeared. Totally disappeared from the face of the earth. They found her car on the side of a road.
I've heard of that.
And Agatha Christie was gone. They brought in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes, obviously, to help investigate and find her. And they eventually found her in a hotel, booked under the name of her husband's lover. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on in this place. So reading about Christie and her life, I gained more of an understanding of what she's talking about and what she wants from this play.
And as a woman watching and really looking at all the female characters and even the male characters as well, it's really a great study in what it means to be a woman. Can you have your cake and eat it too? A lot of the people, like he said, they're hollow, they're unhappy. And as a female watching it, and in today's time with the past we've had as women and kind of growing up in the world, and can you have a family, and can you work, and how do you juggle all that? Can you have your cake and eat it too? And I just really love watching how Agatha Christie, each character, especially with the women, they win in one area and then they lose in another, and just to kind of analyze that and see.
And a lot of life is like that.
It is, yeah. Yeah, to see, well, how do you stay content? Lady Angutel, in a lot of ways, has the most contentment, even though she's absent-minded. But then we also have a redeeming love story in the show, so there's something for everyone.
Mm-hmm. This play, it is so, there's a, over the mantle, there's a large picture of the family's estate, Ainswick. And Ainswick is in everyone's heart, wanting to return to Ainswick, which was, Lady Angutel was born there, grew up there, but she was a woman. So the major estate was passed down to her nephew, and she so wants it to be kept in the family. And her nephew is not married, and what's going to happen to that estate? Because at this period in time, not the royalty, but the upper echelon of society can no longer afford these estates. And the common man who is making money hand over fist is buying up these estates. And so there's a lot of hysteria. What will happen to Ainswick? It has to stay in the family.
This is life after Downton Abbey.
Yes. Yes, it is. It very much is. And so it's that change. It's that turmoil of the world shaking around you and trying to hold on to what was, when that will never happen because everything moves forward. And it's how they attempt to deal with it.
And where can people go online for more information?
People, obviously, you can go online at ChattanoogaTheaterCenter.com. And theater is T-H-E-A-T-R-E, and center is C-E-N-T-R-E. Or you can just call the box office, and they can help you with the box office.
All right. Bob, Johanna, thanks so much.
Thank you
very much for having us.
On Saturday, Heart for Africa comes to the Chattanooga Convention Center. The event, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., supports Exile International, which cares for rescued child soldiers and children orphaned by war in Africa through art therapy, treatment programs, schooling, and more. Valerie Edwards is with Heart for Africa. Valerie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did Heart for Africa get started?
My husband bought me a book in 2015 called The Color of Grace. It's written by Bethany Haley Williams. She's actually the founder of Exile International. I read that book and it just compelled me to do something, just changed me. So I told my husband, I said, I think I want to do a fundraiser to raise money for this organization. So in 2015, we had our first Heart for Africa, and we were going to just do it in our home, but I started just reaching out to different organizations in different places. So my first donation came by surprise from a cigar manufacturer, and they donated $3,500. And I was like, oh my goodness. So it just kind of started. At that time, I started getting in more donations, more support. So we decided that I think this is going to be bigger than our living room. So we held our first event at a local venue. And then we raised over $9,000 that year. And then we had our second one in 2016. And it's just kind of grown from there.
Now tell us more about Exile International.
Hey, Exile International, they are based in Nashville, and they work in the rescue and recovery of children of war. And their approach is holistic care, which is a three-dimensional rescue program. They do mind, body, spirit, and they do a lot of art therapy, which is kind of a new treatment thing. And so that's what their mission is about, and empowering children of war to become leaders for peace.
And where do we see their work?
They work in Uganda and DR Congo and Africa.
What drew you to their cause?
I have a compassion for children, and I just couldn't believe that these things were happening to these children. I mean, they were just horrific acts of violence. I just felt called to do something, and I just prayed about it, and that's how it all came about. And I do work with children, so I just couldn't fathom that this was going on or taking place, so I just felt a call to do something.
So tell us more about the Heart for Africa event that's coming up.
Okay, the Heart for Africa event is on March 14th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Chattanooga Convention Center. And we have our live auction. And we have Allie Kays doing a live painting.
And Allie is there because your mission involves art that helps people through their trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're actually friends with them as well. So she's been a painter she's painted at all of our events. And she helps raise funds. So she's been involved with us since our first event.
Tell me how important that is, art as a tool to cope with trauma.
Exile actually has a neat program. They give the children a handkerchief, and on one side of the handkerchief, they draw their trauma that they've experienced, and then on the other side of the handkerchief, they draw their recovery, like what they've been through and then how they've recovered. It's just kind of like a redemption story just on a handkerchief. So it's really, really neat.
Have you had a chance to meet children, other people who have been helped by this program?
No, I've actually never been over there or anything, but Bethany Williams, the founder of Exile, she actually is coming to our event, and she does a presentation about the work of Exile, and shows videos and stuff, so she will be in attendance at the event.
Tell me more about her, how you got to know her and what she's all about.
She's a wonderful person. She has one of the biggest hearts that I know, and she has a great redemption story of her own, and she speaks about that also in the book, The Color of Grace. So that was kind of a neat introduction into how she started the foundation and everything. So it kind of goes along with her mission.
And where can people go online for more information?
They can go to the Exile International website, or actually if they want to get in contact with me about the event, they can go on my Facebook page, and also they can contact me for h4achat@gmail.com.
All right. Valerie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at @ScenicRoots423 and email us at ScenicRoots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.